Okay, now we're turning our attention to how our managers and policy makers dealing with climate change adaptation for biodiversity and what are the greatest challenges. We'll have four speakers in this session. The first is Colin Yates. Colin's a principal research scientist with DET. He leads their climate change research group. I'll leave it at that. He's got many other wonderful attributes as well.
Okay, great. Thanks, Grant. I'll fess up now. I'm neither a manager or a policy maker, but I do work for an organisation that's responsible for managing biodiversity in almost a third of the continent. And in the last couple of years, my main focus has been on trying to build some climate change research capacity, both within the department and reaching out into the academic community to help us inform how we might deal with this problem. So, first of all, I'll just acknowledge a large number of people that I've been fortunate enough to have worked with in the last couple of years and am working with at the moment, and I'm sorry if I've forgotten anybody. One of the first things we did was look at the existing biodiversity data sets that we had within the department and within Western Australia to see what kind of, how we could use them perhaps. And this one popped up and it hadn't been used, and it just had been languishing there. But this is one of the original citizen science projects undertaken anywhere in the world, actually, back in the 1980s. It was organised by Steve Hopper. And it recorded the, it got people to go out and record the locations of benches right through the South West Land Division. And it's become quite a useful data set for modelling. Now, some previous work was done by Matthew Fitzpatrick and co. on trying to understand how climate change might play out with the genus Banksia in the southwest. And so we've built on that by including some consideration of habitat fragmentation. And the top figure here shows where sites were for the Banksia Atlas survey, and at each one of these sites, every Banksia was recorded. And the bottom area actually shows the extent of habitat transformation in the southwest. So when we talk about interaction of threatening processes, when we think about climate change, we really need to be thinking about this massive transformation. And the pale yellow bits, of course, is the area that's been cleared. We also had another very good data set on the quokka, an endemic marsupial, and a lot of work's been done on this, so we had a good idea of what its pre-distribution might have been at pre-European settlement and what its distribution is now. So I'll just describe these studies a little bit. We used three scenarios, or climate impact scenarios, to model the impacts of climate change on these species. And these encompass, I guess, the range that the Indian Ocean Climate Initiative has suggested might play out in southwest Australia. So the blue ones are historical, the green ones are low impact scenario, the yellow points are moderate impact scenarios, and the red crosses are high impact, and it's rainfall versus temperature. So you can see the whole southwest just shifting and drop, climate envelope shifting towards hotter and drier conditions. And, it looks like we're probably committed already to this kind of change here, which is in the realm of 2 degrees. So, just to give you a snapshot of how things played out, we organised Banksia into biogeographic groupings. There were ones that occurred on the diverse northern sand plains, species that were occurred right throughout the southwest, and then species that occurred on the south coast. And what we found was that when we didn't take habitat fragmentation into account, quite often the northern species would expand, their bioclimatic envelopes would open up. But when we considered habitat fragmentation, what we found was that where they were expanding into was all cleared land. And so in these maps, the coloured areas represents the modelled range of the species. The blue area represents the area where there's actually bush. And here's the low, medium and high impact scenarios. And this is at times into the future. I guess the point I just want to make is that, even under a moderate amount of climate change, you can see that the net outcome is that this species range is projected to contract, both as a consequence of the changing climate space, but also as a consequence of the land clearing that's already gone on. Okay, so if we took a south coast species, thanks to Gardner and I, the predominant response in these species was contraction. And so again, you can see that habitat fragmentation does play out and have a big influence, but primarily the species just contracts within its range. And so if you were thinking about some of the adaptation measures, obviously for the northern species, creating habitat, assisted migration might be useful. For the south coast species, it's really probably about managing refugia. Okay, so if we look at the quokka, just quickly, it did predominantly what you'd expect for something that is restricted to cool, moist environments. In other words, it's the worse the impact scenario got, the greater the amount of climate change, the bigger impact is likely to be on its distribution. So, in this moderate scenario, we're really talking about, if you look at its historical range here, it's restricted to the high rainfall bits on the Darling Scarp and then the west parts of the south of the state. There's potentially a huge impact on this species. Okay, so having said all of that, there's a hell of a lot of fine print in these models. And as Grant said, they're really useful heuristic tools, they're quite indicative, but there are a lot of things that we don't take into account, and Steve mentioned those kinds of things in vulnerability analyses. So, we see them as a first step in a bit of perhaps a guide, a sensitivity analysis, but we've also invested in trying to understand what the adaptive capacity of our systems are, and can we stress test them to try and get some sort of sense of what they can cope with. And so the next project that I'm going to describe is a project that's been led by Neil Enright at Murdoch University and Ray Freund at Edith Cowan University. And it's focused on the northern sand plain of Western Australia, around the Eneabba region. Now, this is an area of extraordinarily high plant diversity, and it's recognised as being a hotspot within the hotspot. And if you also look at the climate projections, it's in the Midwest region, and this place in the regional models is predicted to have the greatest amount of temperature change in Australia just about. So it's going to get really hot there if things play out as projected. plants survive over the long summer on water either stored in the soil or accessing water deeper in unconfined aquifers. And so there's been quite a bit of work done on this by Will Stock and Ray and co on the coastal plain, but less so on the northern sand plain. And the only place you find the benches is on the top of sand dunes, and we hypothesise that's because there's more water stored there. But that's what we're seeking to understand. But really, the aim of the project is to develop dynamic models of rainfall, soil water storage, and plant water use. And you can see a sap flow there here for measuring that. And through those models, being able to model, and in turn, what that means for plant growth and plant demography. So we're kind of interested in being able to model what changes in rainfall might be and how much this system can deal with and what's its natural adaptive capacity. Associated with that work is some experimental work. That's this is pictures of Abby Williams, PhD. She's doing that at Murdoch. And in the top left corner, you can see some rainout exclosures. And these are areas where rainfall is being excluded, about 30 to 40%. And to see what goes on with growth and plant water use and reproduction in those areas. And in the bottom one, you can see what are open top chambers where we're actually doing some warming. Now, so Grant mentioned the idea of the interaction between climate and fire. Obviously, fire is a really important ecosystem process in these Quangan shrublands. And the potential for change may come following fire. So it may be that the seedlings are the most vulnerable stage. And so the treatments have been repeated in a post-fire situation. Okay, so just a few quick key points that I don't think we've really picked up, but planning for climate change is a challenge because of the uncertainty about the magnitude and rate of climate change, the climate tolerance and adaptive capacity of species. We have really poor knowledge of that. Complex interactions among species and non-linear dynamics of ecosystems. So ecosystems often don't behave in ways that we expect they will. I think that credible scientific assessments of vulnerability are still needed, and that's an important part of adaptation. But given that there are potentially a lot of impacts to happen, and we could go on ad infinitum understanding what the actual tolerance of the systems are, only the most optimistic and least risk-averse among us would consider that we shouldn't act. And clearly, this has been picked up before, urgent action is needed on mitigating greenhouse gas emissions. But we're already committed to a certain amount of climate change, and an increase of 2 degrees C by the end of the century looks inevitable. And just if you look at those maps that I put up earlier, you know, that could be quite a big impact on the southwest. So consequently, there's an urgent need for initiatives and actions that reduce the vulnerability of natural and human systems against climate change. And clearly, this is what where research is moving at the moment. And I think Grant put up these before, and if you read the literature, you see the same things popping out. As Steve put up the list. And so, I don't claim to have any answers on how we are going to do adaptation. I think we're currently feeling around and things, there's a few things starting to emerge. But what I would say that's really interesting about this list is that quite a few of them are things that we're already doing. And while there are some positive gains in those areas, biodiversity continues to decline. And so we need an increased commitment to these things. And so I would say there's a hell of a lot of really low, useful social and economic and psychological research that could be done, because a lot of these things are going to happen at a policy level. There's a lot of science underneath them as well, but there's a lot of policy settings that are needed to make these things happen. Okay, so just finally, how am I going on time, Drew?
I'm probably over that.
Okay. Just quickly, I think there's great potential. You've seen what the southwest looks like. There's great potential for restoration there. That carbon capture of re-veg, of agriculture, and there could be additional benefits for biodiversity. But currently there's no policy that links carbon and biodiversity. So it'll be an impediment. This is a project that Grant briefly talked about, and again Steve talked about the importance of refugia. It's work that Gunnar Keppel's been doing, and he's there in the room somewhere, so you can have a chat with him about it. And finally, the department actually has a lot of experience in translocations. And Matt talked about the Western Swamp Tortoise. Well, on the flora side of things, 55 species or 90 populations have been translocated or reintroduced by the department. Now, these are things that are already on the critically endangered list. Ex situ conservation is the last step, but we're already doing it, and there's great expertise in seed storage, and Ann Cochran sitting in the room who managed the Threatened Flora Seed Centre. I just would make the point that we have moved species out of their historical range because of Phytophthora. And so there is a precedent, but, you know, just moving something out of its historical range actually involves a change in policy. But what I would say is that currently climate change has given little consideration in our translocation, and that needs to change. And I'll leave it there.